From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Muslim youths arrested in Kenya. We'll have the latest on the Ebola outbreak, Somalia's political crisis, plus EU sanctions against Ukraine separatists. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Normans. Tension high in Kenya's coastal town of Mombasa after police stormed two mosques controlled by radical youths. One person was killed, more than 200 young men arrested, and the security sweeps in the neighborhood of Majengo. Security officials say they have recovered weapons and grenades. Mohamed Yusuf in Nairobi is following the story.
In a dawn raid, Kenyan police stormed the Musa and Sakina Mosque when worshippers were performing morning prayers. Security officials say one person was killed in the crackdown at the Musa Mosque. According to Mombasa police officer Geoffrey Mayek, the storming of the mosque was prompted by reports that weapons were stored in the mosque and youths were planning terror attacks.
We have been receiving information that there are a number of firearms and grenades which are hidden inside the Sakina Mosque and Musa Mosque. So we planned for an operation last night. In Sakina Mosque, we recovered three hand grenades and one pistol with six rounds of ammunition. Musa Mosque recovered five grenades and some hangers and knives.
Mayek also says they have arrested 251 youths and the investigation is ongoing. Mombasa Deputy County Commissioner Mahmoud Salim has called on the Muslim community to take charge of the two mosques where the previous leaders were all driven out by the youths.
Misikiti ina sheria yake, ina wanakamati, ina wadhamini. Lakini misikiti hiyo miwili ni kama imepoteza mwelekeo.
A mosque has its own rules and laws and it has committee members. But these two mosques have all lost direction. We want the Muslim community to sit down and tell us the way forward. But when we hear people committing crimes, when you are told someone is passing there and has a gun, tell me, how are you going to wait? Security forces first stormed Musa Mosque in February of this year. In that raid, they recovered weapons, knives and video discs and flags, which bore the symbols of Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. Authorities have accused clerics in these two mosques of radicalizing the youths in the run-down neighborhood of Majengo. Security analyst Andrew Franklin tells VOA that Kenya's security agencies repeatedly use the same tactics to crack down on people it perceives to be terrorists, but the problems remain.
The problem continues to come back in much more serious forms, and there seems to be no intelligence going to the police. It just seems to be a situation where you continually round up youths. That plus the extrajudicial killings of so-called radical preachers and imams. There are a whole host of unsolved gun and grenade attacks, and it seems to be just a general groundswell of opinion, of anti-government opinion.
Dozens of Muslim clerics, both radical and moderate, have been killed in the streets of Mombasa over the past few years. Since the death of radical Kenyan cleric Sheikh Abubakar Sharif, also known as Makaburi, the radical youths have lacked a vocal supporter or leader, and much of the activities have gone underground. In the last 6 months, the radical youths have decided not to speak to the media, but to operate in groups to carry out attacks against people. They perceive to work with the government in providing information, as well as security forces and moderate clerics. Police say there has been an increase in gun and knife attacks in the streets of Mombasa, targeting innocent people by the radical youths. Earlier this month, Sheikh Salim Bakari Mwarangi, who supported the effort to stamp out radicalism in the restive coastal region, was shot dead by unknown assailants. In June, the chairman of the Council of Imams and Preachers and Sakina Mosque preacher, Sheikh Mohammed Idris, was killed by a known gunman near his home. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Somalia's political crisis is growing, with 14 ministers asking the prime minister to resign due to his intense political rift with the president. Standoff between the two men has paralyzed the government for the last couple of months. Abdulaziz Billo has more from Mogadishu.
More than half of Somali cabinet ministers have joined calls seeking the immediate resignation of Prime Minister Abdiweli Sheikh Ahmed to end the political stalemate with the president. At issues are disagreements over political appointments, which has also divided parliament. In the past week, lawmakers failed twice to bring a no-confidence motion in the Prime Minister to a vote in what turned into a raucous session where debate had to be suspended. MP Abdurrahman Hosh Jibril says a small number of lawmakers should not be able to disrupt the work of Parliament.
He
says it is unacceptable for 40 MPs to disrupt a session where more than 220 MPs are meeting. He says if the Speaker of Parliament is unable to handle the House, then as MPs they will seek his resignation. Meanwhile, lawmakers from both camps have been meeting in Mogadishu hotels on ways to break the impasse. MP Abdi Barre, who supports the Prime Minister, insists that the no-confidence motion is unconstitutional and his colleagues will block the vote at all costs. He says we are blocking the motion because it was politically motivated and never emanated from the floor of the House. Therefore, it is unconstitutional. It has been less than a year since lawmakers ousted Prime Minister Abdi Farah Shirton in a similar manner. Tension between President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud and the current Prime Minister has sparked international concern that Somalia could slide back into political turmoil, slowing progress towards stabilizing the war-torn country. The United Nations has led international efforts to create a stable central government in the country after more than two decades of violence and chaos and an insurgency by militant group Al-Shabaab. The UN Special Envoy to Somalia, Nicholas Kay, offered to help Somali leaders reach a mutually satisfactory compromise. He also expressed concern about reported vote buying in the political standoff and warned that any action by any party that creates political turmoil will be reported to the United Nations Security Council. President Mahmoud called on the international community to respect the sovereignty of Somalia, saying a Somali-led process is the only way to end the current political crisis. Abdulaziz Bilal for VOA News, Mogadishu.
Human Rights Watch says the police in the Democratic Republic of Congo have executed dozens of people in an anti-gang operation. The report is based on witness testimony into the police operation launched last November to decrease criminal gangs. The rights group urged that the commander of the operation be suspended and that a judicial investigation be launched to prosecute those responsible. Congo's government could not immediately be reached for comment. Mali has placed nearly 600 people under surveillance who are suspected to have been exposed to Ebola. West African nation is struggling to contain a minor outbreak of the deadly virus after three people, including a Ghanaian imam, died in recent days. President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita visited Mali's border with Guinea to see efforts to control the spread of the disease. Mr. Keita told residents he's actively commanding the fight against Ebola and urged residents not to cross the border without a health check and washing their hands. Friday, the World Health Organization announced the outbreak had left 5,177 people dead with about 14,000 confirmed cases. Meanwhile, the French president's point man on Ebola, Jean-François Delavassie, has called this a decisive week for Mali. He warns the handful of new cases could be the start of a new outbreak and said a handful of French epidemiologists are in the former French colony in order to help. On Monday, Dr. Dan Johnson of the Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha announced that Sierra Leonean Dr. Martin Salia, being treated for Ebola, has died. Dr. Salia was the third Ebola patient to be treated at the hospital and the second person to die of the disease in the United States. He arrived from Africa late Saturday in critical condition. Here's Dr. Johnson.
Shortly thereafter, he developed severely low blood pressure and required multiple agents at very high doses to maintain even a marginal blood pressure. In this setting and in the setting of multiple treatments for specific for Ebola virus disease, and despite the amazing care of our nurses and respiratory therapists, he progressed to the point of cardiac arrest.
International Red Cross officials speaking Monday in Brussels warned Ebola is still spreading in West Africa, and they're having difficulty recruiting healthcare workers to combat it. They warn the virus is flaring up in new villages in Liberia and are sending a team of experts to Mali to assist that country's health authorities. Also on Monday, while speaking to soldiers, U.S. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel talked about American efforts in Liberia.
We have, in our enterprise, our role there, as you know, is to apply those unique capabilities to help and assist the caregivers, our own interagency institutions that are there to help the Liberian people, the people of West Africa, contain this terrible disease and virus.
This current outbreak of Ebola is the worst on record, and once again, according to the World Health Organization, it has killed 5,177 people, mostly in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says Islamic State fighters in Iraq and Syria are losing momentum in the face of coalition airstrikes against them. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports those militants, who are also known as ISIL, have beheaded a fifth Westerner and warned that U.S. soldiers will meet a similar fate.
Secretary Kerry says that overall, the international campaign against ISIL has begun to have a significant impact.
The momentum that ISIL built up during the summer has dissipated. It continues, yes, to commit terrible crimes. But it has also been forced to relinquish bases, abandon training sites, alter its mode of communications, disperse personnel, and stop the use of large convoys.
President Barack Obama launched that campaign in September after the group expanded its control of territory in Iraq. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says Washington is accelerating its training and advising mission in Iraq, with special operations forces in early missions with Iraqi troops in the volatile Anbar province. Speaking to foreign policy leaders in Washington Monday, Secretary Kerry said Islamic State influence, left unchecked, could inspire broader violence beyond the Middle East.
The dysfunction of some governments in the region has enabled these killers to seize control of more land and more resources than Al-Qaeda ever had on the best day of its existence.
Kerry says atrocities committed by Islamic State militants have helped build the coalition against them, acting as a force multiplier, as he says governments that cannot agree on almost anything else agree on the imperative of confronting and defeating them.
Where once there was suspicion and discord, we now see the Saudi foreign minister link arms with Iraq's Kurdish and Shia leaders. We see the government of Turkey agree to allow Kurdish fighters to cross its border and take on ISIL. We see the multi-confessional leadership of Lebanon jointly resisting armed incursions into their territory.
Islamic State militants beheaded U.S. aid worker Abdulrahman Kasig, who was captured in eastern Syria in October 2013 while delivering relief supplies for Special Emergency Relief and Assistance, the aid group he founded. As with earlier beheading videos, the one released Sunday features a militant speaking in a British accent. He said the militants are burying the first American crusader in the northern Syrian town of Dabig and warned U.S. soldiers will meet a similar fate. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
North African jihadist group Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb has released a video showing a French and a Dutch hostage pleading with their respective governments to negotiate their release. The video, posted on popular jihadist website, is divided into two scenes showing each hostage in a different location. French and Dutch officials said Monday that they are aware of the video. European Union has imposed fresh sanctions on Ukrainian separatists, but is holding back a new sanctions against Russia. Lisa Bryant has more on the decision by EU foreign ministers amid deepening tensions between the West and Russia.
European foreign ministers meeting in Brussels agreed to target more Ukrainian separatists for travel bans and asset freezes, but they are divided over whether to toughen sanctions against Moscow. The United States and the European Union have already imposed several rounds of sanctions against Russia for its role in the conflict in Ukraine. The new EU foreign policy chief, Federica Mogherini, says if conditions are right, she will visit Moscow for talks on how to end the standoff. She says the 27-member bloc wants a broad dialogue with Russia.
Russia is for sure part of the problem, but is also for sure part of the solution, of the possible solution to the crisis. How to engage with Russia in a dialogue between Kiev and Moscow, between Kiev and the east of Ukraine, between European Union and Russia, not only on Ukraine, but also on a wide series of elements, global regional issues.
The European Union is also calling for Ukraine to commit to more political and economic reforms.
We strongly believe that this combination of three elements, attempt to have a political engagement, economic pressure with sanctions, and support and ask for a commitment on the Ukrainian side on internal reforms, could hopefully lead the way to some positive developments that at the moment are not definitely there.
Relations between the West and Russia are at their lowest level in years. Moscow has deported several European diplomats in recent days, and Russian President Vladimir Putin received a cool welcome from his Western counterparts at the G20 summit in Australia. Earlier Monday, German Chancellor Angela Merkel warned the effects of regional conflicts could quickly broaden into what she called major fires. Germany has just marked the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, a symbolic end to the Cold War. Meanwhile, President Putin says neither Ukrainian separatists nor Ukrainian government troops are fully abiding by a truce signed in September, but said peace is still possible. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
In September, information networks of two U.S. government agencies, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the U.S. Postal Service, were attacked by hackers based abroad, but officials did not report the incidents until late October. Agencies declined to say where the attacks originated, but independent experts often suspect Chinese government sources. They also say the number of such attacks rose from 2009 to 2013 by as much as 13%. VOA's George Putich reports.
Hackers are constantly probing U.S. government agencies trying to find out what sort of data is accessible. The White House and more recently the State Department have also reported attacks on unclassified parts of their systems that were quickly contained. But the incidents point to the vulnerability of the government's vital networks. Finding out whether the government is doing enough to protect its networks is as hard as finding out who is behind these and other similar attacks, says LaSalle University Adjunct Professor of Information Security Dean Henry. The Philadelphia cybersecurity consultant says vulnerability opens when people forget what he calls basic cybersecurity hygiene.
Not only in the federal government, but in general, people are tending to enable these attacks by clicking on links or visiting websites that have malware attached to them, and thereby opening a door for an attacker.
Henry says many attacks come from the same sources and are executed in the same way, so sharing information about them is very important. But federal legislation enabling that type of information to be shared has been moving through Congress slowly. The Cybersecurity Information Sharing and Protection Act was introduced in 2013 and passed in the U.S. House of Representatives, but it has not been voted upon in the Senate, which has introduced its own version of the bill. Henry says U.S. internet security also suffers from a shortage of cybersecurity experts.
I think the root cause of the shortage may be lying with undergraduate education and also basically schools where the STEM skills, science, technology, engineering, and math skills aren't being taught in volume enough, or students aren't being attracted to them enough to feed that pipeline.
Henry says fighting cyber attacks is a never-ending battle, and everybody must be aware of those threats.
It's not just the federal government or corporate America. It really gets down to individuals and doing really basic things, as basic as changing passwords, using difficult passwords, not having passwords the same on different sites. It's basic security awareness and training for everyone.
As cell phones are increasingly becoming devices used for exchanging work-related messages, Henry says this will be another big area of exposure. He says the best protection from cyber attacks are long, complex, and frequently changed passwords. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
In a case that triggered weeks of widespread protest and allegations of racial discrimination in the U.S. city of Ferguson, Missouri, a grand jury is deliberating on whether police officer Darren Wilson should be standing trial for the fatal August shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown. In this report for VOA TV, Victoria Machi explores whether the teenager's death can or should change what some Americans believe is an unacceptable status quo.
That a white police officer in Ferguson fatally shot an unarmed black teenager is not in dispute. Almost everything else is.
The case is seen very differently whether you're African American or whether you're, you know, white.
Lawyer Debbie Hines, who blogs about the Ferguson shooting, notes one survey indicating that 80% of black adults believe the case is about race. Among white respondents, that number drops to 37%. Many of those who see race as a key issue in the teenager's death want discrimination addressed on a national level. The civil rights group NAACP has asked the Justice Department for policy changes to address police violence against black Americans. Among their demands, more diversity in law enforcement and more police officers who are members of the community they serve. Experts on the interaction between police and minority communities say this is key. Public policy expert Elsie Scott helped diversify New York City's police force.
Because of this distrust and this disconnect between the black community and the police, you can still end up with a major incident if you have not engaged your community, if you don't have black people on your police department.
That disconnect in Ferguson is stark. A nearly all-white police force in a largely African-American city. For some, the issue of race can obscure the particulars of an individual case. Bill Johnson represents police unions in Washington.
And like it or not, and regardless of the color of the people involved, regardless of the socioeconomic standards, regardless of the history of the police department, for an individual officer, if his or her life is threatened, or if they reasonably believe it's threatened, they have the right to use force.
He also argues that putting minority police in minority communities is not the solution.
If you pursue that and it goes too far down that road, it really ends up with a form of the kind of insidious discrimination that's there. And I think that that's it doesn't solve the problem. I think if you send a message also that to a community of color that, well, you can't trust the white officer.
The Justice Department is conducting probes into Michael Brown's death and the Ferguson Police Department. The initial investigation does not include a review of the hiring practices that made the Ferguson police an almost exclusively white force in a majority black city. Victoria Mackey, VOA News, Washington.
Pope Francis has announced plans for his first visit to the United States next year to attend a global conference on families in the eastern city of Philadelphia. Francis already has visited Eastern Europe, Asia, South America, and the Middle East during his 20-month reign. Church leaders in the U.S. say his itinerary likely will include visits to New York and the United Nations as well as Washington, but the Vatican so far has only confirmed the Philadelphia destination. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is straight ahead. And a reminder, if you find yourself on the Internet, we're there at voanews.com. Just look for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Tuesday.
This is Today in History. On November 18, 1493, Christopher Columbus first sighted the island now known as Puerto Rico. In 1497, Portuguese explorer Vasco da Gama reached the Cape of Good Hope on the way to establishing a sea route from Europe to India. The new route would permit trade with the Far East without the use of caravans along the costly and unsafe Silk Road. It would also lead to a several hundred year era of European domination through sea power and commerce. On this day in 1626, Pope Urban VIII dedicated St. Peter's Basilica at the Vatican in Rome. With construction beginning in 1506, St. Peter's is one of the world's largest churches. It's the birthday of American statistician George Gallup. He was born in 1901. Gallup was a pioneer in scientific polling techniques. His name became a household word. While editor at the Daily Iowan newspaper in the early 1920s, Gallup conducted what is widely considered the first poll in human history. He took a survey to find the prettiest girl on campus. The winner was Ophelia Smith, whom Gallup later married. In 1903, a treaty was signed by the United States and Panama, giving the United States exclusive rights over the Panama Canal Zone. In 1926, George Bernard Shaw refused to accept the money for his Nobel Prize, saying, "I can forgive Alfred Nobel for inventing dynamite, but only a fiend in human form would have invented the Nobel Prize." On this day in 1928, Mickey Mouse was born, Walt Disney's Steamboat Willie, premiered in New York at the Colony Theater. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Pakistan's National University of Sciences and Technology, or NUST, hosted U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan Richard Olson for a discussion with students and faculty on November 12th. Ambassador Olson thanked Lieutenant General Muhammad Askar, rector of NUST, for hosting the event and supporting academic exchanges and linkages with U.S. institutions. Ambassador Olson emphasized the importance of cooperation between the United States, Afghanistan, and Pakistan in order to support regional stability and prosperity. A strong relationship between our two countries is of great importance to regional stability and to achieving a more prosperous future for our citizens, Ambassador Olson noted. One of the most critical ingredients for achieving regional stability and prosperity is creating a peaceful and stable future for Afghanistan, he said. The ambassador spoke about the results of the Declaration of Enduring Partnership signed between the government of Afghanistan and NATO in 2010 to provide long-term security, economic, and political support to Afghanistan and the importance of regional efforts to its continued success. An increasingly stable Afghanistan that is at peace and enjoys productive relations with its neighbors will be an effective counterweight against extremism. A stable Afghanistan is also conducive to economic development in South and Central Asia, he said. The ambassador reaffirmed the enduring U.S. commitment to Pakistan and the region, saying, "The United States will remain engaged. We see our role in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the region as one of a sustained commitment that is in our own national security interest as well as that of the countries of the region. Calling on the students at NUST to play a role in leading Pakistan to a more stable and secure future," Ambassador Olson concluded, "You have an opportunity now to choose a better future and put aside the differences of the past. Pakistan is a young society, and so is Afghanistan. Young people in both countries can make the choice now to set the course for a positive and constructive direction. I hope you will seize that opportunity and rest assured that the United States is committed to supporting you in your critical role to help Afghanistan through this period of transition.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.